thank y'all for coming out this evening. It's my first lesson, so I'm excited, and I'm a little nervous as well, so I just want to thank y'all for all being here. Before I start, I always like how Paul does the slides in that show, basically God's creation, so I'm going to turn up all these lights real quick. I was shown a video like this in my 8th grade science class, and I have been amazed by it ever since. And I'm a little disappointed because I couldn't figure out how to get the video to work, but I have two pictures, so that kind of would just have to do. And so, I don't know if you can tell, but this is kind of a grainy picture, but this is just basically comparing the size of all the planets in our solar system. So obviously they're very small. This, you can't even really see it, but that is Pluto. It's extremely small, and you have Mercury, Mars, Venus, Earth, and then all the bigger planets, and then obviously the big one is the Sun. And, you know, when we look at the Sun, it doesn't look that big, but that's because in reality it's 92,955,807 miles away from the Earth. So that's why it doesn't look that big. But scientists estimate that 1.3 million Earths can fit inside the Sun. So if you were to say the Sun was like a bowl, Earths are like ping pong balls, you would be able to fit 1.3 million Earths inside of the Sun. And so what is really amazing to me is this. And so I don't know if you can kind of tell from this picture, but UY, I don't even know how to say it, Scuti, I'm not really sure, but UY Scuti is the largest star that man has discovered. It is a red supergiant star, and it's located in the constellation Scuti. And so imagine this just being a ginormous circle that goes all the way around. And that is the star UY Scuti. And then this little tiny dot is our Sun. And so just thinking about how large that star is, that is mind-blowing to me. And scientists say the width is difficult to calculate, but scientists estimate that the width, just the radius or the diameter across the star, is 1,700 times as wide as the Sun. And so the Sun, the radius of the UY Scuti is 735,039,200 miles wide. And so earlier I said 1.3 million Earths can fit inside the Sun. Well, scientists disagree, but some say that 5.1 billion of our suns could fit inside of that star. And others think it's only like 430 million. But either way, that is a lot. And one thing I thought was interesting, when Paul gives his lessons and he does, you know, over constellations, and he says, oh, it's 17 million light years across. You know, you think about how huge this is. I calculated it. That star is 0.000125 light years across. That is incredibly small compared to how large these other constellations are. And so when just thinking about that, I mean, God made all of this. He created all of this. And just, I remember, I was probably Jake's age. I walked in and Tim Chase was giving a lesson here. The lesson was, how big is he? Just, how big is God? You know, he creates all this stuff. And, you know, as a little kid, hearing the story of God creating the planets, I think of just a human with getting some Play-Doh, kind of rolling around, making a ball, you know, they're stupider. That's what I was imagined. And then, obviously, that's not how it works, but it's just kind of mind-blowing to think that God makes all this, and it's so large that the human brain can't comprehend it. And in saying all this, this proves the evolution theory, because people who believe in evolution, you know, they believe the Big Bang happened, and then over billions of years, all the different elements in the Earth, or all the different elements in the universe collided, made planets, and made life, and then, you know, billions of years later, here we are. I was reading a book that Mike gave me, and it gave a little metaphor that I really liked, and it was that if that were to happen, it'd be like an open book sitting next to a printer. All of a sudden, that printer explodes, and the result of that explosion is a fully complete Webster's Dictionary. Like, it doesn't happen. It's very illogical. And so that's just mind-blowing to me, and I've always loved how that just shows God's creative power. Well, anyways, tonight I'm going to do a character study. Grandpa always likes doing his character studies, and I found the story of Korah and his rebellion very interesting. So, there's Korah's rebellion. But before we go any further, we have the chance to go to God in the word of prayer, so let's do that. Something I forgot to mention earlier, I think it's a funny story. I don't know, Aaron tells me my sense of humor is terrible, so y'all might not find it funny, but I always thought it was funny. When Tim Chase was giving that lesson titled, How Big Is He? I remember, this has always stuck with me, but I remember when we were walking into the church house, I kind of tapped my dad, hey, Dad, how big do you think he is? He kind of looks 6'1". I guess he was talking about Tim Chase. I was talking about God. We had a little misunderstanding, but that's always stuck with me. But anyways, tonight, the story of Flora takes place in number 60. And if you want to flip there, that's where we're going to be during the majority of the lesson. And this story shows the dire consequences of rebelling against God and his authority. And I've always loved this story because, in a way, it kind of sounds like an action movie with heroes and villains. Challenging the heroes, and in the end of the story, the heroes are victorious and the villains are defeated. Korah was the son of Izhar, who was the son of Kohath, who was the son of Levi. And so basically, Korah was the great-grandson of Levi. Coming from the tribe of Levi meant he also was from the same tribe as Moses and Aaron. And joining Korah in his rebellion, two of the other leaders were Dathan and Abiram, and they were both from the lineage of And together, they took men and they rebelled against God, or rioted before Moses and Aaron. And in total, there were about 250 men. In Numbers 16 and 3, it reads, "They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, 'You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy. Every one of them and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?'" So basically, they were just asking, what makes Moses and Aaron so special? Why did they get to be in charge? Because as I said earlier, Korah was from the same tribe as Moses and Aaron. They were all from the tribe of Levi. And according to the Old Testament, the tribes, descendants of Levi were supposed to be the ones that were the priests and the ones that were in charge. And so technically, according to the old law, Korah could have been in charge. So they were just asking, what makes y'all so special? Since this congregation is holy, why do just you two get to be the leaders? Why can't there be three? And one thing that Korah did not understand was that Moses didn't just appoint himself. He didn't just kind of one day say, I'm going to be a leader. I'm going to bring Aaron along with me. Moses did not do that. Moses was put in that position by God, and that's what God had intended. And if you want to flip to Exodus 3 and verse 11 through 12, it says, "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?' And so he said, 'I will certainly be with you. And this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain.'" So when Moses was commanded to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt, he was appointed by God to be a leader. He was appointed by God to be the leader of the Israelites. And so when hearing this riot, this rebellion from Korah and his followers, the Bible says Moses just fell on his face. And so back to the Numbers, verse 16 and verse 4, it says, "So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face and spoke to Korah and his company, saying, 'Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and he will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, will cause to come near.'" And so basically, I always thought of this as he's challenging Korah. And so as an athlete, football, basketball, baseball, everything is competition to me. Even getting as many groceries at the car as you can, carrying more than Jake, which is... that's a competition. Everything's a competition. So when I read that, I think of Moses challenging Korah and his followers to a competition. And so in most competitions, you have one team, which is, or I would say in most movies, like sports movies, you have one team that's the good team and one team that's the bad team. And then both teams are competing and trying to prove that they are the greater than the other. On the good team is Moses and Aaron, and on the opposing, or the bad team, is Korah and his followers. And so to compete in their competition, they had fill censers, which were just metal canisters, and they had to fill them with fire and with incense and bring it before the Lord. And the Lord would just choose whichever one he wanted. So whoever the Lord chose would be considered holy and which would be the leader of his people. And obviously, due to his revolt and his rebellion, Korah thinks that he can do just as good of a job as Moses and Aaron. He thinks that if he can be a leader, or if Moses and Aaron can be a leader, he can do just as good of a job. And so what Korah does not realize in rebelling against Moses and Aaron is that he is also rebelling against God. He just thinks he's going against Moses and Aaron. He does not realize that Moses and Aaron were put there by God. So in a way, he's going against God. And throughout the Bible, God does not like to have his authority challenged. And so the next day, when everyone met for their competition to see who God would choose as holy, they met. And the two censers were filled with fire, and they were laid with incense. And they were both set at the door of the tabernacle. Then the glory of the God appeared to all of the congregation, all the people that were gathered there. And so in verse 20, it says, And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And so, I don't know about you, but if I was like a part of that congregation, and I was sitting there listening to God say that, I would be very freaked out. Just saying, God, you know, get away, because I'm about to consume these people. And so, I would have honestly taken off running. But, and so I would just assume, since he didn't want to frighten the people, in verse 23 and 24, and it says, So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Get to the congregation, saying, Get them away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So hearing that would make me feel a little bit better, knowing that not everyone is going to be consumed, but just those few people. And then so after saying that, then the ground split apart, and the earth swallowed up Korah, and Dathan, and Abiram. Since they were the leaders of this rebellion, they were swallowed up first. I've always kind of thought this was sad, but I mean, I don't want to say they had it coming, but I mean, they did rebel against God, so in a way they did have it coming. But not only were those three men, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, swallowed up, but at the same time, their families, all their possessions, children, anything they owned, everything was swallowed up by God. And so, as this was happening, as the ground opened up and everyone was swallowed, everyone around all the congregation, all of the Israelites, fled. Were worried they would be swallowed by the ground as well, which honestly was what I would have done too if I was in that situation. But not only did the Lord consume Korah and his fellow leaders, he took care of every other one of his followers. As I said earlier, there were 250 men in total. And so it says in Numbers chapter 16, verse 35, it reads, And a fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. And so although they might not have been leaders and along with Korah, they were still his followers and they still revolted against God. And so the other 250 men were just set ablaze, I guess, as a way to say it. And so after all of this happened, I mean, I would think that the revolt, the rebellion, it's all over. You know, Korah and his fellow leaders have been taken care of. All 250 men have been taken care of. So you would think that this is just kind of a done deal. It's over. But the children of Israel started to complain. And so, in the past, the children of Israel had been known to complain. When they were in Egypt, they complained about the manna, so they had been known to complain in the past. And so, after all this has happened, the following day, the children of Israel and that congregation said to Moses and Aaron, You've killed the people of the Lord. Just like Korah, the people in the congregation were rebelling against God, even though they didn't really realize it. They were just kind of mad that Moses and Aaron, who they thought had killed those people, they were just mad that they had been killed, and they didn't really realize what they were saying. They didn't realize that they were going against God. And so, as I said earlier, throughout the Bible and every story, God did not like having his authority challenged. And anybody who challenged God and his authority were always met with retaliation, and it was often very violent retaliation. And so, for this challenge in his authority, in the middle of the night, God sent a plague among the congregation, the people in the congregation. And so before Moses and Aaron stopped this plague, they pleaded to God saying, just, you've done enough, just let them be. And so they pleaded to God before it was a total catastrophe. But, I mean, before they were able to stop the plague, 14,700 people were still killed by this plague. And so, in conclusion, I always, looking at stories like this, I think it's important to look for any kind of lesson you can learn in these types of stories. And then especially looking back at history, I think it's important to ask the question, why did this happen and what can I learn from it? And so in the story of Korah's rebellion, what can we learn from that story? And to answer that question, I think it's pretty simple. I mean, he revolted against God. He rebelled against God. And he was met with very, very violent, very rough retaliation. And so, I mean, put it simply, don't go against God. Throughout the Bible, people went against and tested God and his authority. And it never ended well for those people, by the way. I think the best lesson we can learn from this story is to just do what God tells us. Don't go against his word. And just follow him. And that, I mean, that's pretty simple. If you want to flip over to Jude verse 11, it says, Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily into the error of Balaam for profit, and have perished in the rebellion of Korah. And so in Jude verse 11, Jude was talking about kind of the same thing I am. He was talking about going against God and challenging his authority. And so when speaking about this topic, he goes over three specific examples, story of Cain and Abel, Balaam and Balak, and then obviously Korah and his rebellion. And so he gives, I would refer to them as probably the three worst times that people were met with retaliation, or either you can consider it the three most important times. And so obviously Korah is in that three, so you know that this story of Korah and his rebellion is very important, and we need to realize how bad this was, but at the same time learn about how important it is to learn from this, and so we don't make the same mistake. And so overall, I think it's pretty simple. Just don't go against God, and just follow whatever he has to say, and then if we do, it's kind of said throughout the Bible that it will be met with retaliation. Well, anyways, those are my thoughts for this lesson. I hope something that was said was beneficial, and